Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about making a list and checking it twice. Not a list for presents, but for New Year's resolutions. Whether it's sleeping more, smiling more, exercising more, or maybe doing less, it's that time of year. But anyone can write down a list of resolutions for the new year. How many of us can keep them? This hour, we're talking about how to change old habits and create new ones with Charles Duhigg, author of The Power of Habit. Charles, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So is there any reason to believe New Year's is a good time to make resolutions?
There actually is. I mean, so logically, you would think that it really doesn't matter what time of the year a resolution would have impact on us. But it turns out that there's been a whole bunch of studies that have looked at sort of what psychologists call these mini moments, right? There's in particular a woman named Katie Milkman, who's an economist, who has studied why New Year's resolutions seem so effective. And what seems to happen is that on an almost subconscious level, we begin anticipating moments of change in our life. And when those moments arrive, if we're prepared to change during them, we somehow sort of take that change more seriously. It has a longer lasting impact. Now, that doesn't mean, as everyone listening knows, that simply making a New Year's resolution means that 6 months later you're 30 pounds lighter and you're running a half marathon. But it is good to make these changes on this kind of predictable schedule, because there's something about how we think about change that the period beforehand helps us get ready for it.
I wonder, I don't know if you know, how far back the tradition of the New Year's resolution goes.
Well, I don't know specifically the New Year's resolution, but even if you look at biblical writings, there's obviously periods of every single year that are about renewal and that are about change and are about seasons transitioning from one to the other. I think that people have known intuitively for a long time that if you wake up tomorrow and you say, my life is changing today, the odds that it's really going to change are hard. But if you're thinking to yourself, you know, I really need to change my life, and 2 months from now, it's New Year's Day, and that's a good time to start a change, it helps get you in that mindset where you can learn what you really need to do to change your behavior.
I remember reading that people who change habits while they're doing something unusual, they're on vacation or they're in a new place at a new hotel, tend to keep those habits longer. Is that true?
Well, that's exactly right. And this gets into what the neurological structure of a habit is. And when I wrote my book, The Power of Habit, it was really about the fact that we've discovered this new science of habit formation. And in particular, what we've learned is that every habit inside our brain has three parts. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for an automatic behavior to start, and then a routine, which is the behavior itself, and then finally a reward. And that reward is how your brain learns to anticipate, to make that behavior automatic. Now, what happens when you go on vacation, for instance, is that suddenly all these cues that you might not even be aware of, they all suddenly change. Right. So if it used to be that you had a cigarette with your cup of coffee every single morning at home, trying to quit smoking at home, it's tough because you're surrounded by all those cues. It's part of your normal morning routine. But then you go on vacation and suddenly you're having coffee at a different time of day. You're having a different type of coffee. You're sleeping in late. The cues have changed in your environment. And so it's easier to be conscious of what's driving your behavior and to make a slight shift.
I wonder.
Not only that, but you're. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, I wonder then if maybe we shouldn't pack and prepare everything as usual for when we go on vacations. Maybe leave it up. I'm sort of an OCD packer. I like to have everything that I usually would have. Maybe that's not the best thing to do.
Well, and what's interesting is how much of your environment change even if you do have everything that you normally have, right? So I think it's an interesting question. You know, one of the big pieces of dieting advice, and studies show that this is effective, is to tell people to start a diet when they go on a vacation, which we know is effective. It's easier to change when your environment shifts a little bit. That being said, when we go on vacation, it's also sometimes nice to kind of indulge, right? So
don't
I think
go to New Orleans or Dallas
there.
Where the restaurant culture is big. And so if you're not going on vacation, what's a good way to disrupt those sort of environmental cues?
So the first and most important thing is to diagnose the cues and the rewards that are driving your behaviors, right? And cues are really interesting because almost all of them fall into one of five categories. It's usually a time of day or a particular place, a certain emotional feeling, the presence of certain other people, or a preceding behavior that's become ritualized. And what's interesting is that when we're in the grip of a habit, our brain actually sort of powers down. It stops paying attention to what's going on. And so it's very easy for us to ignore the cues around us, to not be aware of them. So the first step is to force yourself to kind of be aware of what the cues might be that are driving this particular behavior that you want to change.
Let's take an example. I'm thinking of a common one, maybe nail biting or chewing on a pencil or something.
I can use an example from my own experiences. When I was writing this book, I had this habit where I would – every afternoon – I'm a reporter at the New York Times. And every afternoon I would like go eat a cookie in the cafeteria, which was up on the 14th floor. And it got to the point where I actually put a piece of paper on my computer monitor that said no more cookies. And I managed –
Very effective, to, like, I'm sure.
I managed to ignore it for like 20 minutes every afternoon. And so when I was talking to all these neurologists and psychologists, I would ask them – I would say, I have this friend with a bad cookie habit, and I was wondering if you could tell me how to help him change it. And they said, well, first of all, start with the cue, right? So write down, whenever that cookie urge strikes, write down those five things I mentioned. Who's around you and what time of day it is and how are you feeling? And after just like 3 days of doing that, I realized pretty quickly the cookie urge always struck between about 3:15 and 3:45 in the afternoon. So clearly my cue was a time of day. But then that's not enough to figure out how to change a habit, right?
You can't just skip that time of day.
Exactly. What I really needed to figure out was what the reward was. Why? What was I getting from eating this cookie that was sort of making it almost an unconscious behavior? And at first I thought it was just the cookie, right? Because cookies are yummy. And the neurologist I talked to said, no, that's totally wrong. Like a cookie is like 15 or 16 rewards all kind of in one tasty little bundle. And they said, look, you got to figure out, like, is it that you're hungry and the reward is that you're satisfying that hunger? Or is it that you, you want some taste sensation? In which case, if it was hunger, an apple would do the job. Or if it was taste sensation, just like eating some sugar would probably do it just as well. Or is it that you just need a break from work? In which case, just taking a walk around the block would do the trick. And so for about a week, I experimented with these different things to sort of see, did it make the cookie urge go away? And what I realized pretty quickly was that when I was going up to the cafeteria to get a cookie, usually I'd see two or three friends up there. And I'd sit down with them and we would sort of chat and gossip for, 20 minutes. And I realized that it was the social experience was the reward, that I was craving some type of social interaction. And the cookie was basically just an excuse to get that. And so once I'd figured this out, once I diagnosed what's known as the habit loop, that the cue was a certain time of day and the reward was a social experience, I could create a new behavior, a new routine. And so now every day at about 3:15, I stand up from my desk and I look for someone across the newsroom to go gossip with. And I go over to their desk and, we gossip about whoever's out of earshot for like 20 minutes. And then I go back to my desk and the cookie urge is totally gone. But that only worked because I diagnosed the cue in the routine.
Now, you got I bet the cookie people, whoever sold you the cookies, are pretty upset with you.
I think they've got lots of other people.
Okay. Not after this show. Now everyone's going to hear and they're going to stop buying cookies. But did you replace that bad habit with something else or did you break it? And what's the difference?
Well, so this is one of the big insights. It's actually known as the golden rule of habit change, which is that it's very, very difficult to break a habit, right, to extinguish a habit. Because what happens is that when you develop a habit, you essentially have neural pathways associated with a specific cue and routine and reward. And extinguishing those neural pathways is almost impossible. In fact, they've done experiments with rats where they'll teach them a certain habit. And then, months later, they'll drop them back in the old maze where they develop that habit. And the behavior will pop right back. So the key isn't to think about breaking a habit. It's about changing a habit. And the way that you do that is that you diagnose the cue and reward and you find some new behavior that corresponds to the old cue and that delivers something similar to the old reward. So in my case, I had a cookie habit. I replaced it with a new habit, which is a get up and gossip for 20 minutes in the newsroom habit. And it works almost exactly the same way. I mean, I sort of feel this urge to do it every afternoon. But the point is that instead of simply trying to extinguish this behavior, I diagnosed and then tried to shift it to a different, better behavior.
It makes me a little bit sad. I'm not sure why, that we can't really get rid of a habit. It's sort of like this constant cycle of replacing habits with other things like paper mache.
Well, but I understand that. But on the other hand, think about what your life would be like if it was really hard to develop habits. There was a woman named Wendy Wood at Duke University who followed around hundreds of people for almost a year to see how much of their daily behavior was habits and how much was decisions. And what she discovered is that about 40%, 40 to 45% of what we do every day is a habit, right? When you leave your home in the morning and then you're at your desk and you don't really remember exactly what happened between leaving home and getting to work, or when you sort of think to yourself, I'm going to have a salad for lunch today, and then you walk into the cafeteria and get the same unhealthy sandwich that you get every single day. Those are habits taking hold. Almost half of what we do every day is a habit. And thank goodness for that, because what we have found is that from an evolutionary perspective, the ability to develop habits and develop habits easily, and a part of the brain known as the basal ganglia is essential in this, that gives every single species a huge evolutionary advantage, because it means that instead of having to make hundreds and hundreds of decisions every single day, instead of having to think about how to get to work and what you're going to eat for lunch and how to put one foot in front of the other, you can develop habits almost automatically. In fact, your brain will try and turn any regularly occurring behavior into a habit.
It sounds dangerous.
And that's why we're able to, for instance, think about the upcoming meeting on our way to work.
Yeah, it's fascinating that we can do that. I mean, and it's been shown, right, that decisions are exhausting, and that the more decisions that we have to make throughout the day can wear down our willpower.
That's exactly right.
So how does that play into habits?
Well, what's really fascinating is that it turns out that the best way to teach willpower is to teach people how to make it into a habit. So many of your listeners are probably familiar with one of the most famous experiments in the science, the study of willpower, which is the marshmallow test. Mm-hmm. There was a researcher at Stanford named Miskal in the 1960s who had a 4-year-old daughter, and he took her and a whole bunch of her classmates into a room. And one by one, he'd put in front of them a marshmallow, and he would say to this 4-year-old, I'm going to leave the room, and you can eat the marshmallow if you want. But when I come back 10 minutes from now, if the marshmallow is still there, then I will give you a second marshmallow. Now, I have a 4-year-old at home, and like promising a 4-year-old a marshmallow is like the greatest gift ever, right? There's nothing more desirable than a marshmallow. And so he did this experiment. He found about 30% of the kids could somehow go 10 minutes without eating the marshmallow in order to get the second marshmallow. The 30% of kids, in other words, had this willpower reservoir. And so he started wondering, can I give other kids more willpower? Because we know that willpower is connected with doing better in school and having more friends and getting better paying jobs and going to college. And he wondered, how do I teach willpower? And he and a woman named Angela Duckworth, who's done a lot of research on this since then, have found that one of the best ways to teach willpower is to teach kids how to make willpower into a habit. That is that when, for instance, they see something tempting, they habitually hide that tempting thing by putting a piece of paper over the marshmallow. Or they teach themselves a method of pretending that there's a frame around the marshmallow so that the marshmallow seems more like a picture rather than like an actual piece of candy.
Wow.
And what they found is that you teach kids how to do this and you give them rewards for doing it. And more importantly, you teach them how habits work. You teach them that if you want to develop a habit, then you find some cue, like seeing a marshmallow, and your automatic response should be to put a piece of paper over it so it doesn't tempt you. And the reward is to kind of pat yourself on the back, to let yourself feel good about that.
Okay, we'll get back to more marshmallows in just a minute. We've got to take a quick break. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. And this hour, we're talking about how to keep and those New Year's resolutions with Charles Duhigg. He's author of The Power of Habit. You can join the conversation. Call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. And we'll be back with more tips and tricks for New Year's resolutions after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Whether you want to spend less, read more, or pick up a new language, New Year's is often a time to lay out goals for a better year. We're talking about how to finally reach those goals, or at least some of them, with Charles Duhigg. He's author of The Power of Habit. Charles, what is the best way to keep track of your resolutions and to monitor yourself?
There's a lot of ways to do it, right? I think sometimes people write lists or writing lists is a pretty good way, right? It seems to work pretty well. But what's important isn't so much how you keep track of them. What's important is the community that you make them in front of. Hmm. So one of the things that we know is that change is much easier to achieve when you're surrounded by other people who are aware of the fact that you're trying to make a change. And oftentimes it's even easier when they're trying to make a change themselves.
So that makes me think, of course, of one of the most famous examples of a support group like Alcoholics Anonymous.
Exactly. Exactly. AA is like this perfect example of how this works. And what's interesting about AA is it's totally unclear why AA is so effective. The people who created AA, Bill W., none of them had any background in psychology or science, for that matter. The reason why there's 12 steps in a 12-step program is because there's 12 apostles in the Bible. It's not based on any kind of like science. But for millions of people, AA is this incredibly effective tool. And scientists have tried to figure out why. And what they've discovered is that one of the big principles why is that AA helps you recognize your own habits and change them. And more importantly, it does it in a community where you're surrounded by other people who are also trying to make a change. One of two things happens is that, first of all, you get this positive feedback from other people who are saying, look, I know this is hard. I know that you're struggling with it. And I think you're doing great. And that's so rewarding, right? Not only does it keep you honest, but it gives you someone sort of a comrade in arms. But this other thing happens that's equally interesting is that when you go to an AA meeting or something like that, you're sitting there and you're struggling with staying sober, and you look across the room and you see Joe. And Joe's been sober for 6 months. And you think to yourself, you know, Joe is kind of a moron. If Joe can do it, I certainly should be able to do it as well. There's a negative and a positive aspect to peer pressure that makes change much, much easier in a group. And so you should write down your resolutions, but more importantly, you should find other people who have similar resolutions. You should tell them what your resolutions are, and then you should check in with each other.
So if AA is so successful, as you sort of laid out, and of course it doesn't work for everyone, but it does work for a lot of people, why don't we see the equivalent, say, I don't know, Chocolate Eaters Anonymous or Nail Biting Anonymous, or why aren't more of those groups popular?
Well, what's interesting is that they actually are, right? There's certainly like Overeaters Anonymous and people who engage in self-destructive behaviors. There's 12-step programs for them. But think, for instance, like what Jenny Craig is, or Weight Watchers, or all of those apps that we sign up for where we get paired with anonymous people we've never met and we compete against each other to see who can take more steps today. What those really are is those are kind of modern-day AAs. They find a community for us to help support us and to help us benchmark ourselves. And in doing so, the possibility of change becomes more realistic because you're practicing learning how to believe in yourself by learning to believe that other people have done it.
So that brings up a good point about technology, and this is something that's definitely changed over the years, of whether it's how you keep your list on your phone or on your computer or what have you, instead of a piece of paper or a sticky note. But what technology do you recommend or say isn't helpful for trying to keep resolutions?
Well, I don't think any technology is inherently good or bad. It sort of depends how you use it in your life. A lot of people that I talk to when we talk about habits, they talk about a smartphone addiction, right? And I do the same thing. I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I'll be sitting at the dining room table. We're all having family dinner, and I'll have this urge to pull my phone out of my pocket, particularly because it just vibrated, and so I know there's an email there. And the urge to see what that email says is like almost overpowering. And I know that at 6 o'clock on a Wednesday, no one's emailing me with anything important. It's probably like a fantasy football results or something like that. So the question is like, as these new technologies enter our lives, do they change how habits work? Do they take advantage of our neurology? And the answer is yes, right? That vibrating in your pocket, that ding that your phone makes, that's a cue. And that's a cue that's been designed incredibly well to trigger an automatic behavior. And the reward that you get is this like moment of novelty that maybe that email is important. Maybe it's something fun. It's just something new. So the answer is, it's not that any technology is particularly good or bad, but that we just have to be aware of how the technology around us influences us and take control. Sometimes turn off the notifications or decide I'm going to take my phone out of my pocket and put it in another room during dinner time.
You can join our conversation. We're talking about the power of habits and New Year's resolutions on Think. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. The number is 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones for a second. Let's go to David in Dallas.
Hey, Lauren, I'm a huge fan of yours. I just wanted to call in and say thanks for putting me on the air.
Happy to have you.
Hey, so I just wanted to ask a couple questions. How could habit building be applied to learning? I'm in music and just was interested about building habits and figuring out how I could apply that to learning new. You know, I mean, there's so many ingrained patterns in playing a musical instrument or playing, you know, we just have done it for so long. You know, how could we change some of these ingrained patterns? And is it better to consciously focus on change, or is it better to just kind of let it happen? That's kind of the question that I wanted to ask.
Great question.
That is a great question. So I think to answer the second one, it is definitely better to think about and try and achieve change than to just hope that it kind of happens, right? I think we've all had that experience where we hope for some type of change and we find that 6 months later that change has arrived. But I think all of us probably have many more experiences where we think like, wouldn't it be nice to lose 20 pounds? I'm not going to think about that or plan around it. And 6 months later, we still have those 20 pounds. So I think thinking about change and trying to figure out how to do change, that's better in terms of trying to actually achieve it. And this question about learning is a great question because it gets to the issue of how change actually happens. There was this really interesting set of experiments about how learning plays into shifting our habits that were done around cigarette smoking. Cigarette smoking is one of the most studied habits because it's unhealthy and there was a lot of money to study it. And a guy named Prochaskop at the University of Rhode Island looked at a ton of people who had quit smoking. And he went and he asked them, how did you quit smoking? And as he talked to them more and more and more, what he learned was that all of them who had successfully quit smoking, they had unsuccessfully quit smoking numerous times before. In fact, on average, people only finally give up cigarettes on their seventh attempt at quitting smoking.
Wow.
And so the question then becomes, so what's different about that seventh time? And what he found was that the first couple of times you try and quit smoking and you fall off the bandwagon, you just beat up on yourself. You just say like, I don't have the willpower or I'm so weak, and you just feel bad about it. But about time three or four, something happens where someone finally starts saying, you know, why exactly did I fall off the bandwagon? Well, my mother-in-law came over and she made me really stressed out, and like I always want to smoke when I'm stressed. Or, you know, I didn't have time to go exercising, and because I wasn't exercising, I felt unhealthy, and because I felt unhealthy, I started smoking again. What happens, in other words, is that as people fail at change, they eventually realize that they need to start learning from those failures, which isn't obvious at first. And when they start learning from those failures, they start coming up with contingency plans. So they say, look, I'm going to quit smoking, and I know that it's going to be hard when my mother-in-law comes over. So this time when my mother-in-law comes over, I'm going to go for a jog half an hour after she arrives because I need a backup plan in place to keep me off of the cigarettes. And that's why the seventh time on average is so powerful, is because finally, people have started to see failure as a learning opportunity. They've seen their previous attempts as experiments rather than failures.
So there it sounds. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that's how learning occurs with habits.
There, it sounds like it could be really dangerous then to say, well, this is my fourth time trying. I should just not try again. Or when someone tells us they're trying to quit doing something or to start doing something and we laugh because we say, oh, well, you've tried that five times.
That's exactly right. In fact, the fact that they've tried it five times means that they're more likely to be successful this time. you know, if you think about we would never go to a child who picked up a book and struggled with the book and say, well, you're clearly never going to be a reader. I guess you're going to have to be illiterate for the rest of your life.
Gosh.
Because we recognize that learning is something that takes time and it involves failures and setbacks. That is the essence of learning, is learning from those setbacks. But when we become adults and when we start thinking about habits or about behaviors that we're sort of embarrassed of, it's as if we turn off that part of our brain. But we shouldn't. We should embrace the fact that we can learn from our mistakes. We can see previous attempts, not as failures, but as experiments. And that's how change actually occurs, again and again and again in study after study.
It's really that our habits and breaking them and creating new ones are a chance to learn if we so dare to take that up.
That's exactly right.
Let's go back to the phones now. Let's go to Natalie in Plano.
Hi. I had a question regarding habits.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm trying to break a bad habit of interrupting others, and I just have attempted it many times. And I would like to know what would be a good start or another attempt. What should I do different this time?
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions on that, Natalie. So when you interrupt other people, if you had to describe to me what was going through your brain or why you have a craving to do that, what would you say?
Well, I'm a soft speaker, and I sometimes feel that I don't get to be heard, and people just say their opinions, and they don't really listen to mine. So maybe I have a feeling, I mean, I've looked into this, and I think I'm doing it for that reason, that I don't feel that I'm being heard.
And when you do interrupt someone, do you feel any type of satisfaction? Like, do you feel like you are heard?
Yes, because it seems like when I'm waiting patiently, I don't get to voice my opinion, and that person doesn't give me a chance. I mean, they're saying what they want to say, but they're not waiting for me to voice my opinion.
That makes a lot of sense. And what's interesting about that to me is that you know what the reward is, that when you interrupt someone, you probably see them suddenly like be forced to pay attention to you, right? You interrupt their stream of thought and you force them to recognize you, to see you and to hear you. And
right.
So now the question becomes, how can you find another behavior that delivers a similar reward? And let me ask one other thing about this. When you find yourself interrupting people, are you feeling anything in particular? Are you feeling frustrated? Or are you feeling – what do you think the cue might be?
I think I'm feeling frustrated. I'm sort of – I'm giving longer wait time, like, because I'm aware of it more now. And my time never comes, like, to voice my opinion. I just – then after a certain amount of time, I feel like I'm interrupting or I have to interrupt.
I think this is fascinating because this is exactly sort of how you diagnose and change a habit. And there's a whole school of science behind this called implementation intentions, which is about changing habits and creating habits by identifying a cue and choosing a plan ahead of time and then choosing how you're going to recognize the reward. So we know that the cue is that you feel frustrated. And we know that the reward that's driving this habit is that you see that someone is forced to listen to you. So what if we were to do this? What if the next time that you're feeling frustrated, what if you were to say to yourself, sometime in the next minute, when there is a break in the conversation, I'm going to speak. And the first thing that I'm going to say is I'm going to say something kind of loud, and I'm going to watch everyone look at me. Right? So it's the same cue, and the reward is very similar. You're going to notice that everyone is listening to you.
Uh-huh.
And what you're going to find, I think, is that by coming up with this implementation intention, by coming up with this plan, your brain almost subconsciously is going to start seeking out these more appropriate opportunities for you to talk. And you're going to become much more sensitive to noticing the rewards in your environment and as a result, feeling good about the choices that you're making. It's not a huge shift, and it might take a couple of, you know, weeks for it to really sort of sink in till it happens automatically. But just thinking through, how do I want to change just a little bit? What's the cue that I'm going to tie that change to? And when a reward comes, I want to make sure that I allow myself to see it and to enjoy it. That's how you can change a behavior like that.
Some great advice.
Thank you.
Now, that brings up a good question, Charles, about how long it takes to generate or to replace a habit, and in turn, how to form a new habit.
Right. There's this like great like 21 days, right? Or 18 days, or there's different yeah. there's different kind
Lots
of myths
of books
out there
that tell you about that. Yeah,
exactly. I unfortunately, according to all the science out there, there is no magic number. If you would like to start a habit that involves eating chocolate, you could probably do that in like 30 minutes. on the other hand, if you want to like start exercising regularly, it might take a little bit more time. So there's unfortunately no like magic number. It depends on the person. It depends on the type of behavior you're trying to influence. But what we do know is this, is that basically what's happening when you build a habit, neurologically speaking, is that your brain is taking a cue and a routine and a reward, and it's developing a neurological connection between those three things. And as that neurological connection, a pathway within your brain gets established and it becomes used more and more and more, it essentially becomes thicker and thicker and thicker. And as a result, it's easier for electrical charges to move along that pathway. So the takeaway is this, is that every single time you reinforce a habit, it gets a little bit easier. Now, you're not going to be able to know that it's feeling easier because it's so minuscule. But what's going to happen is that over time, eventually it's going to start to feel automatic. And you probably won't even notice that it feels automatic at first because your brain will essentially be not paying attention. But the promise is that it's going to be easier to keep your diet on day 3 than it was on day 1. And on day 30, it's going to be easier than it was on day 3. And at some point, it's going to end up feeling automatic and you won't even have to think about it. You just got to stick with it. And even if it feels hard, no, it's getting easier every single time you do it, even if you're not totally aware of it.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in today for Chris Boyd. This hour is all about you and your New Year's resolutions. Here to help is Charles Duhigg. He's author of The Power of Habit. This is also your chance to ask questions and bounce off ideas, whether they worked or not, for creating new habits. Call 800-933-5372, or you can email us, think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from Charles Duhigg after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd today. We're talking about how to create healthy habits for the New Year's and keep them. Maybe you make New Year's resolutions every year, or you might be like me and avoid the whole thing altogether. Either way, habits are hard to change. Our guest this hour is Charles Duhigg. He's author of The Power of Habit. I'm going to get personal for a second, Charles, and ask if there's a habit you might be willing to share that you haven't been able to break.
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, there's lots of habits.
The share part is a little bit different, I guess.
And let me just say, you know, so to your brain, there's no such thing as a good habit or a bad habit, right? Your brain just has this capacity to build habits, and it's valuable to do that. And it's only us who decide that some habits are good or bad. The brain looks for things that are rewarding and cues that predict it, and it says, I'm going to make that into a habit because it brings me a reward. So you know, if you have a cocktail after work every day and it doesn't bother you, that's okay. It's okay to have a cocktail after work. That's not a good habit or a bad habit. That's just a habit. It's entirely our judgment that makes it so. Now, that being said, there are habits that all of us wish that we could change, right? And one of them – and I will actually say my life kind of was transformed by writing this book, because when I learned how I could change habits, I started changing all these behaviors in my life. I – started training for a marathon and I lost a bunch of weight and I found it much easier to exercise. And I diagnosed and designed all these behaviors in my life that became automatic and relatively easy to achieve. One of them, though, that I continue to think about is trying to be present with my children. So I have two young kids and it's really easy to tune out when you're with kids, right? Like to think about the stuff that's going on at work and to just spend time, you know, in my own head. In fact, it's easier to do that than it is to like kind of concentrate on your kids, because oftentimes your kids say something cute, but then they say like things that aren't that cute. Anyone who has kids understands exactly what I'm talking about. Or to get like kind of wrapped up on something going on at work. Someone sends you an email and like you start thinking about how you're going to respond to it. And so what I've tried to do is I've tried to make a habit of being much more present, of taking those interfering thoughts or those distractions and putting them aside and saying, okay, look, the cue is that I'm with my children and I want to remember this time. I want to experience this time and to be present. And then I know that I have to give myself a reward for that. And so what I actually do is after I spend half an hour with my kids, I sit down and I like make myself kind of remember the best moment of that half hour. And I allow myself to feel good about being a good dad. Because one of the things that actually happens very frequently is that your brain pays attention to rewards. It learns to do things because it gets a reward for it. But sometimes in like modern life, we deny ourselves rewards. We feel like we should be more stoic. But it's allowing yourself to indulge that reward, to enjoy that reward. That's what makes it more automatic in your brain. And so when I spend time with my kids and I'm really present, I just allow myself to enjoy that, to feel good about myself for doing it, and not think to myself, oh, I have so many emails, I should have spent that time doing it.
That's interesting.
I allow myself to invest in it.
That reminds me a little bit of a habit that I had picked up a few years ago, but I've stopped doing a reward system more so, actually, that sounds similar, where at the end of the night, and I've heard this suggested by several psychologists who say if you want to be more present throughout the day, try and remember before you go to sleep to sort of pick out a few moments, say three moments throughout the day that you really enjoyed, or three things you saw that really stood out.
Yeah, it's. I mean, in many ways, you can think of the brain as this like incredibly powerful, sophisticated machine that is kind of dumb sometimes. Right? That you can give it the most simple instructions and it can make those do wonderful things. But that if you don't give it any instructions, that it kind of runs off the tracks on its own sometimes. And so by forcing ourselves, and you know, there's a lot of research going on about mindfulness and gratefulness and things like that. And those are all kind of fancy words. But at the end of the day, what it's really talking about is, how do you train your brain to pay attention to the things you want it to? And we know that the way that we do that is by giving it rewards. It's like a puppy, that if we give it a reward, it'll learn to do something in the future. And so if you want to learn to enjoy your day, to pay attention to the parts of your day that are enjoyable, then you have to give yourself some rewards when those occur and let yourself enjoy them.
We're talking this hour about how to create new habits with Charles Duhigg. He's author of The Power of Habit. And the number is 800-933-5372. Or you can email think@kera.org. Let's go back to some of the people who are calling. Let's go to Wes in Dallas.
Hello?
Hi, Wes.
Yes, Charles, great book. It's really exciting.
Oh, thank you.
That's over probably the last 30 years, suffered depression off and on, and I just wanted to share something which is not, I didn't say, it's just the cognitive therapy, where if you're aware of your thoughts and you sort of choose what you allow yourself to think, I found that very powerful in alleviating depression by simply, identifying a thought that would lead me down, sort of like a roller coaster. If you get on a negative thought train, it can take you down quick. But by identifying those initial thoughts that are negative and choosing to think about something or do something else, you can really, remap your brain when it comes to the whole depression cycle. And I just wanted you to talk about that and also talk about sort of brain chemistry, cortisol and the other chemicals that, bathe our brains and how that affects habit form.
Thanks, Wes.
Those are great questions. And congratulations on, you know, I think that people who struggle with depression or who experience depression and learn enough about themselves to really overcome that and learn how to manage their own brains, it's a huge accomplishment. And it shows an inner strength and a capacity for learning that's amazing. And I'm glad you brought up cognitive behavioral therapy, or sometimes it's referred to as CBT, because you're exactly right. This is an incredibly powerful tool, and it's very closely aligned with what we've learned about the neurology of habit formation, which is that most of the habits that happen in our lives are mental habits, right? We get into this pattern of thinking a certain way, and the reason why is because it works for us. There's a reward at the end of it. You know, what's interesting is every single thing that we do has a small that becomes a habit has a small reward associated with it. So even backing your car out of your driveway, right, which becomes habitual, if we could look inside people's brains, and they've done this in studies, they would see that when someone successfully backs the car out of the driveway into the street, that there's a small, like, minuscule sense of euphoria because somebody completed this maneuver correctly. And similarly, when we're making it through the day and we're having happy thoughts or bad thoughts, those exist on a habitual level. These micro habits, these mental habits are so powerful. And learning to control those by learning the triggers that can take you down a bad habit path or a good habit path, learning which ones make it harder for you to cope with life and easier to cope with life, that's incredibly influential because you're learning about the cues that are occurring within your brain. And you're learning how to diagnose and then reshape those in ways that lead to better outcomes.
Let's go back to the phones. There's some fascinating questions here. Brian is calling from Austin, Texas.
Hi. Yeah, I am a really big fan of your work, Charles. I've read The Power of Habits cover to cover twice now because I found it so fascinating. I'm a private music teacher. I teach the clarinet, and I feel like most of my job is changing bad habits. I mean, that's basically all I do all day, every day. And I was just wondering kind of if you could talk about it. It's sort of related to what the previous caller was saying. Some of these habits, a student's only been playing for a year, and yet they're so ingrained it takes me forever to change. Like something like how they form their – I teach clarinet, so how they form their mouth around the mouthpiece. They've been doing it wrong for a year, trying to change it to something more correctly, but unless I'm there telling them you're doing it wrong, they don't change it in their own time.
That is a great question, and thank you for the kind words on the book. I really appreciate it. But it's a great question, right? Because some of these habits, they seem to come on so fast, and then they hold us so strong. And what's interesting is something you just said, you're doing it wrong. So there's been a number of studies that have looked at what type of reinforcement should be provided in order to help people change a habit. And if you'll remember before, I mentioned that teaching ourselves to recognize the reward and allowing ourselves to enjoy that reward, that's really important because that's how our brain learns to grasp on to a particular set of behaviors. Negative reinforcement, we know, is much less powerful than positive reinforcement. So there's been a series of studies that have looked at things like how people go and exercise or how they learn to do specific skills. And in one group, what would happen is that the coach would tell them how to change what they were doing. They would say, you know, you should throw the ball this way or you should lift the weights that way. They would give feedback about where they were falling off the correct path. And we would think that that would be very effective because that's what a coach does, right? They tell us what to do different. The other group of coaches would look at another set of people, but very similar, and they would never give any feedback like that. Instead, they would simply compliment them when they did something right. Now, trying to figure out what was right took longer, right? Because we have to kind of stumble into the correct behavior without someone coaching and guiding us and critiquing us when we make a small mistake. But it turns out that people would stumble into the correct behavior and they'd get positive reinforcement from the coach, and that correct behavior would take hold with an iron fist. In fact, the people who never got any negative feedback, who never got any critiques, but only got positive praise, they actually ended up finding the best ways to do something and learning how to do them again and again and again faster than the group that got critiques. And so I think one of the things, and you know your students better than I do, and you know what teaching music is like, so I'd be curious if this rings true to you, is that instead of saying, you know, you should change this way, you're doing it wrong, the more you say, hey, look, I saw that you just practiced four scales. I want you to know that second one was amazing. You did it exactly right. That, scientific, according to studies, is a more effective way of causing that change to become permanent.
So it sounds like the best way to actually change someone else's habits, although you can't necessarily do it, is to do positive reinforcement, even though that gets made fun of a lot, to say, well, there's so much praise. You don't want to give someone too much praise.
I think as anyone who who's parented knows, it's pretty hard to give too much praise. But that's exactly right. And it's the same thing with ourselves. It feels silly to give ourselves praise. Like, it feels silly to, like, you know, pat ourselves on the back and say, you only jogged half a mile today, but really good work with that half a mile. Instead, we say, like, I should have done a mile. But what we know is that our brain latches onto that praise. If you praise yourself for running half a mile, it's going to be easier to run a mile next time.
What about the opposite of that? And we don't have time to take more calls right now, but some people are writing in, and someone's writing in to ask about how to handle binging. And this is something that I could see many people feeling the opposite of praise, very guilty. Self-guilt may come up after something
Absolutely.
Like that. How do you handle self-guilt, and what do you do with that guilt?
What's interesting is that very frequently – so one of the most powerful rewards, in addition to praise, one of the most powerful rewards is removing tension. In fact, that's why people bite their nails, is because when you bite your nail, it actually – there's a small burst of pain, right? And that pain tends to overwhelm the part of your brain where tension and anxiety reside. So pain becomes a reward because pain is preferable to tension. When people binge eat, it's oftentimes to try and resolve some tension. And once you realize that, if you can find another way to resolve that tension, it becomes easier not to binge eat. The point is just not to beat up on yourself and say, I'm such a loser and I have no self-control. It's to try and diagnose that behavior. Diagnose the cue. Diagnose the reward. Figure out how to change the routine. The biggest takeaway from the science of habit over the last decade is any habit can be changed. It doesn't matter if you've been smoking for 30 years. There are people who are lifelong smokers and they will quit tomorrow and never smoke again. It doesn't matter if you're 65 and you're overweight. There are people who are that age who will start a diet tomorrow and they will keep the weight off for the rest of their life. Any habit can be changed if you know how to tease apart the cue, the routine, and the reward, recognize them, and then rebuild it the way that you want it to be.
Inspiration for the new year. That's Charles Duhigg. He's author of The Power of Habit. Thank you so much, Charles, for your time, and best of luck with your resolutions in 2016.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canaby. This hour, Lindsay Connect took your phone calls. She's associate producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. And you can contact us anytime via email, think@kera.org. Thank you so much for listening this week, and have a great new year.